Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Today we're looking at something that's hard to see, something that's obvious afterwards, something that's important, sometimes damaging, and says a lot about human nature. Economic bubbles. Let's start with what a bubble is. You could say it's when an asset increases in price dramatically and quickly, so that the price is unrealistic compared to a benchmark. That sounds simple, but the more you think about it, the more slippery it gets. Timo Henkels in the Research School of Economics at the ANU.
It is a slippery concept, which is why there is so much disagreement even within the economics profession, or perhaps especially within the economics profession. There are plenty of economists who do not believe in the existence of bubbles because they say that the market determines the price based on supply and demand. And if there is a lot of demand for a good or very little supply, then that's going to push up the price. And if that's what the market delivers, then that's the price. There's no reason to think about a price somehow being divorced from its fundamentals, whatever demand and supply is being determined by.
Sally Auld does believe that bubbles exist. She's the chief economist at JP Morgan.
They are a little bit tricky to define. And I guess one thing that's interesting about them is that, you know, when we go back over history, you know, what you observe is that bubbles have occurred in so many different countries, different situations, different asset classes. So everything from tulips to mining stocks, tech stocks, or land in Melbourne back in the 1880s, that it's sort of hard not to believe that at the root of a bubble is effectively just human nature, because we see them repeat so often.
The paradox is that we know a lot about human nature, but rather less about bubbles. Preston Teeter, who lectures in international business at the University of South Australia, says stories, narratives, are critically important.
They're very poorly understood, is the first thing to know. But essentially, it's a situation where expectations of capital gains become taken for granted and assumed, as opposed to, you know, normal situations where investors would make careful decisions based upon fundamental factors. For example, the revenue stream of a company or rental payments from a property. So instead, during asset bubbles, what we tend to see people making decisions based upon are simple stories, stories of a booming market, stories of security and property. We see people guided by their emotions, being envious of others or fearful of missing out on something that's great. We see people guided by so-called experts, for example, stock analysts or real estate agents that have vested interests. And we see people focusing a little bit too much on short-term data, short-term returns, as opposed to long-term trends. So what we see in these situations is that asset prices tend to break away from long-term trends, go exponential, and then eventually parabolic if there's a crash.
Sally Auld says bubbles have a number of characteristics in common.
The first one is probably that they start usually with some fundamental shift which drives them. So they don't just start from nothing. So you might say, you know, the tech bubble was a good example because it started with, you know, new technology which spawned a whole lot of tech companies, and people were sort of unsure about what would happen in the future, and so rules around valuation sort of went out the window. And that was the fundamental change, was the new technology. And then what tends to happen is that the initial reason for investing in a bubble becomes just subsumed in general demand for the asset, whose prices are obviously going up. So what you find, and what has to be the sort of common theme of a bubble, is that they do have, you know, quite a lot of speculative activity behind them in the end. So that would be the first two things. So they're sort of driven by a fundamental change, and then you get speculators involved. I guess there are a couple of other things that usually seem to exist when you have a bubble. One is that there's easy access to credit, so you can participate in the bubble as a speculator by borrowing to do so. And probably the last one is that often you find that bubbles occur when there's a sort of a general sense of optimism. So that's why we often find them at the end of economic expansions, because, you know, people have lived through the good times for, you know, a while, and humans being what they are, they're sort of conditioned to almost believe that the good times will last forever. So I think they're the sort of four things that you look for, you know, when you try and think about what might define a bubble.
That seems like a handy checklist, doesn't it? Spot those four things and you've got a bubble. Easy. Except it isn't.
You know, I've studied asset bubbles all over history, and what you commonly see is that at the beginning of an asset bubble, you know, particularly the first few years of it, it's very hard to form a consensus on the way up that this is in fact a bubble. So for example, I did a research on the tech bubble of the 1990s in the US. And as early as 1994, 1995, you had what you could call doubters, skeptics in the media saying that this was a bubble. However, the stock market continued to climb exponentially for another 5 or 6 years until around the year 2000. So a lot of these early skeptics, they looked quite foolish on the way up. But eventually prices crashed. So by 2003, prices had returned to, particularly in tech stocks, had returned to their levels of around 1994, 1995. So these early skeptics are often right, but they're usually much too early.
On The Money Today, we're talking about bubbles, asset bubbles. And it would be helpful, I think, to have an example. The most famous bubble of all occurred about 300 years ago in the Netherlands. Tulip mania.
By and large, in the first half of the 17th century, tulip bulbs underwent a speculative frenzy in Holland. It was down to some new, by those standards, genetic engineering, some new varieties that were being developed and bred. And some of those were initially quite rare and considered to be very beautiful, and they fetched high prices. And eventually they fetched extremely high prices to the point where the most sought after bulbs around 1637, 38 cost as much as about 10 to 15 times the annual salary of sort of an average skilled craftsman.
Timo, that's just astonishing.
Just because that seems so outrageous, it's hard to imagine how one can think that this was a realistic price, other than a bubble where people demanded these bulbs simply because they were riding the wave of ever-increasing prices and hoping that they were the lesser fool in a greater fool's game, and then they could then sell it for a higher price yet. And what's typical of a bubble, which was also the case in the Tulip Mania episode, was that the gradient, the slope which prices rose, was very steep, and that went into reverse very quickly as well. Prices fell within a few weeks down to a 20th of what they were from their peak. So this kind of behavior suggests what most people who believe in bubbles think of as being highly indicative of a bubble. If the price goes up very quickly, then it typically also goes down very quickly, and often even faster than it went up.
To make sense of this, you have to understand what was happening at the time.
I guess what's commonly less known about the event is that much of the bidding on these bulbs took place in bars and pubs late at night, essentially became a drinking game. There was a large extension of debt, of credit, to the people bidding on these bulbs. They weren't using their own money. They were doing it on debt. And it also occurred at the same time when the bubonic plague was breaking out in Amsterdam, where about 10 to 15,000 people had died in the previous year. So a very emotional sort of alcohol-infused drinking game broke out around these bulbs.
Bubbles are social phenomena. We know that people from all walks of life caught tulip mania. But do we know what caused the bubble to burst?
No, we don't. And that is one of the fascinating aspects, is that even if we are pretty confident that we are experiencing a bubble in some kind of asset, that we don't really know what is going to trigger the reversal. The point is that it's a system that is incredibly complex and fragile. And if we were able to predict where that reversal point is going to be, well, then that in itself would negate it, because of course people would then try to act upon it, and they would try to sell a moment before that reversal was going to take place, before the peak appears, and that, as I said, would negate the prediction in the first place.
If we could do that, we could avoid bubbles. Actually, we seem to be going in the other direction.
For a large period, from the 1950s up to the 1980s, large-scale bubbles were rather rare. In fact, a lot of economists coined the term the Great Moderation in the 1980s to refer to a period in which we feel that we had overcome this sort of volatility, high inflation, and booms and crashes. But this belief has been shattered over the past 20, 30 years. So just a few examples. In the 1970s and 1980s, Japan was one of the largest bubbles the world had ever seen. In the 1990s, their bubble popped and home prices proceeded to drop by about 70%. Their stock market, now we're talking about 30 years later almost, still has not recovered. In the 1990s, we saw the tech bubble, which I just mentioned. In 2001, the NASDAQ, this tech-heavy stock index in the United States, dropped by about 80% over the next 2 years. And then recently, it's really been the past 15 years, which includes the GFC, which many people would be aware of, we've seen enormous bubbles in real estate, stocks, and bonds all over the world, but in particular, North America, Scandinavia, Australia now, and China. And really what we've seen over the past 15 years is unprecedented in terms of scale and scope.
And according to many experts, you don't have to look too far to see another bubble.
Though the government doesn't want to admit it, parts of Australia are in the middle of a housing bubble, one that would have devastating consequences if it burst.
This is a housing bubble for the ages. It's very hard to find two cities in the world outside of Sydney and Melbourne that are seen house prices escalate the way they have already off a very high altitude.
There's a lot of argument about whether housing in our larger cities is a bubble, but Matt Barry is certain. The CEO of Freelancer.com says far too much of Australia's economic growth is coming from housing construction in Melbourne and especially Sydney.
24% of Australia's GDP growth in the last year came from an area from the Sydney CBD to Macquarie Park, which is in the middle of an apartment building frenzy. Today, there are about 685 cranes, according to the Ryder-Levitt-Bucknell Index, across Australia, 83% of which are producing apartment blocks. And if you compare that to somewhere like America, New York today, there are 28 cranes, according to the RLB Index building. There are 24 in San Francisco and there are 14 in Los Angeles. Yet in Sydney alone, we have 350.
Cranes are easy to see. And Matt Barry says lack of affordability in the housing market is pretty obvious too.
We are at an extreme point in terms of where we are in the property cycle, because at the moment, if you compare a metric of dwelling price to average household income, urban planners say that an affordable house is somewhere around 3.0 or below. Unaffordable is about 3.1 to 4.0. Severely unaffordable is 4.1 to 5. And above 5, it's seriously unaffordable. Sydney at the moment is about 13 times, because the average house price is about $1.15 million, and the average household income is about $88,000. So, on these sort of ratios of affordability, we're way off the deep end.
Despite numbers like that, Sally Ord from JP Morgan says there's a hesitation when it comes to using the B word.
I think people are reluctant to call it a bubble because, when you call something a bubble, the implication is that prices have gone up a lot and that prices will also fall a lot as well, because that's typically what we see when a bubble eventually bursts. So I'd probably step back from calling housing a bubble. But what I do think we can say about the housing market, I think you could very easily make the case that house prices started to lift in Australia, because of a shift in supply and demand dynamics. So on the demand side, you might say that we've had strong population growth. Some of our big capital cities like Sydney and Melbourne are considered global cities in certain respects. And so that attracts, offshore demand for housing assets in those cities. And then on the supply side, there are issues around geography. We sort of feel like Sydney is constrained by the ocean to one side, by the mountain ranges to the other. Infrastructure is a big issue. Zoning issues have obviously been problematic as well. So you could argue that there was a fundamental reason for why house prices have been pushing higher relative to incomes, particularly in the larger cities. And then you can also see very clearly in the data that investors or speculators, if you would like to call them that, have also been heavily involved in the housing market, particularly in recent years. And you could probably also make the point, given what we've seen the RBA and the bank regulator talk about in recent months, is that a lot of that activity was facilitated by pretty easy access to credit. So, banks were writing a lot of interest-only loans, which are typically used by investors to fund purchases of investment properties. So, you sort of feel like some of those initial identifiers of a bubble are definitely in place.
Actually, just this week, we learned that the banks are making fewer interest-only loans. They've gone from 31% of new loans in the June quarter down to about 16.5% in the September quarter. But there are other indicators. Timo Henkel from the ANU thinks we have a bubble.
The gradient of the price increase over the last 10 years has been very, very steep. That is not sustainable. And when something is unsustainable, it suggests that it's going to go into reverse at some stage. And more importantly, underlying this demand for housing is an ever-increasing level of household debt. And that is very often the case for bubbles. And that's, of course, where the problem lies, because the debt is denominated in nominal terms. It will have to be paid back. But the asset price is market determined. So if house prices stop rising and even falling, for example, that suddenly means that the balance sheets of the Australian households are going to look a lot weaker. They will have the same amount of debt that they owe to the banks, but their housing stock will be worth a lot less. And if interest rates, for example, start to rise or unemployment ticks up and some of the households will start perhaps not being able to service their debt, they may even have to default, they will then start selling their houses. That puts further downward pressure on the houses, means that more households will then feel like they're underwater and you're in this vicious cycle that self-perpetuates. And yeah, if I look at the debt level, if I look at the house price data, in spite of some of the fundamentals that suggest that house prices should be high, I still think they are way too high. And to me, that looks like a bubble.
We have a beautiful family home here, ladies and gentlemen. Do I hear $1 million?
It's impossible.
$1 million. I have $1 million. $1,200,000. Thank you. $1,200,000.
It's impossible.
How much will this actually cost?
How can we even apply?
Okay. Now let's.
This TV commercial, it's on at the moment, is all about pressing buttons.
We see very emotional decision-making, people jealous, envious of their colleagues, friends, people they hear about in the media, and people fearful that they're going to miss out, that they may never be able to buy a home, or that their children may not be able to afford a home. And despite all of this, we see regulators and politicians telling us everything is going to be okay. And this is, you know, through my research, this is something I found very, very common in these events, all the way up until just about when the bubble crashes, we have the people in charge that should be regulating these events and trying to prevent these events telling us that everything is going to be fine.
Matt Barry isn't buying it. He doesn't think everything's going to be fine at all.
Well, I think we're at the point now where the people that need to, that are vital to running the actual economy can't afford to actually live in the areas that they actually have to work. So I'm talking about school teachers, policemen. Now, in order to be able to afford to live somewhere, you've got to move way, way, way out into the suburbs. And I think, you know, we're just reaching a point now where, look at the banks, for example. The banks are four times more exposed to residential mortgages than Hong Kong, which is the most overpriced property market in the world, three times more exposed than the UK and double the US. I mean, if you look at the amount of debt that Australian households have, we're the second most indebted in the world on a per capita basis. I think this is going to end in tears. And when it does, it's hugely problematic because our economy is extremely simple in nature. You know, if you look at the Harvard Economic Complexity Index in terms of how sophisticated the products and services our country produces compared to other countries around the world, we rank 77th, right? So we're on par with sort of Kazakhstan or Jamaica in terms of the sophistication of the economy.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're talking about asset bubbles. They're delusional, they're dangerous, and they're happening more often. So is there anything we can do about them?
Again, a hotly debated topic in the economics profession. There are those who argue that nothing should be done to bubbles because it's too fraught a policy issue, too difficult to try to get a handle on. And there are others who would argue that one probably has to throw whatever it takes to reduce the fallout of a bubble. So there are two aspects. First of all, the question is there anything that we should try to do to limit the development of a bubble, the buildup of a bubble in the first place? And the difficulty there is that if no one can really agree what a bubble is and whether we are in a bubble, it's going to be very difficult to achieve some kind of policy consensus that something should be done in the first place, let alone what should be done. Those economists, including myself, who are conscious of bubbles and worry about bubbles, think that there should be additional measures beyond, let's say, interest rate policy by the Reserve Bank, along the lines of credit guidance to prevent banks from extending too much credit that is used to prop up the demand for asset prices. How that is actually then implemented in detail is obviously a devilish question. But in principle, there should be policies in place that prevent too much debt being created in order to prop up speculative activity in asset prices.
The problem for policymakers is once you've got one, what do you do next?
Just a slowdown in credit growth, not a reversal of credit necessarily, but just a slowdown in the growth rate of credit being expanded can make these bubbles pop. So for example, in 1991, Japanese banks were instructed to limit the growth of real estate loans. And within just a few years, prices dropped by 60%. In the year 2000, the U.S. Federal Reserve, their central bank, raised interest rates from just 5 to 6%, a small percentage overall. The NASDAQ proceeded to drop around 80%. So my point being, these events do not necessarily cause a crash, but because prices are so unsustainable, because there's no fundamentals supporting them, just small triggers, very small changes, can make things crash very quickly by a very large amount.
That's the challenge for central banks like the RBA, letting the air out of the bubble without affecting the rest of the economy.
That's why, you know, the RBA has said, look, you know, we don't feel comfortable that lifting interest rates is the right response to deal with this, because, you know, we've still got an economy where we sort of wish that growth was a bit stronger. We wish that the unemployment rate was a bit lower. We wish that inflation was a little bit higher. So they've sort of told us that they don't feel like the broad sort of macroeconomic indicators are robust enough to warrant hiking rates. And so that's why they, in conjunction with the bank regulator, have gone for macroprudential tools as a measure to do this. And the big difference between those two things is when you hike rates, that's an instrument that affects everyone with a floating rate mortgage. But when you use macroprudential tools, what you're trying to do is affect the marginal borrower, so the next person that walks into a bank and wants to borrow. And by taking the marginal borrower or the marginal demand out of the housing market, most of which in recent years, you know, I think it's fair to say, has been led by investors or speculators, that's how you try and take, you know, the heat out of the market without completely destroying the market.
And at the moment, Sally Ord says, it's not going too badly.
I actually think, given what we're seeing in the housing market, when you look at some of these high-frequency indicators like auction clearance rates in Sydney, and you're looking at sort of monthly changes in house prices, those measures are actually working, because you can draw a very clear chart of Sydney house prices and growth in lending to investors, and the two sit on top of each other. So I think the idea is if you can sort of take the investor or the speculative activity out of the market without destroying, you know, the supply of credit to genuine buyers like owner-occupiers, then that might be a way of just taking the froth out of the bubble but still allowing people the capacity to borrow. And we've got to remember what the bank regulator wants is for people to borrow prudently and for banks to lend prudently. So they're not saying don't lend, they're just saying don't lend silly amounts of money to people who are borrowing too much relative to their income.
A bubble isn't an ironclad law of economics, it's a social cultural phenomenon. It's behaviour, and that behaviour can be nudged.
The government and the RBA have been trying to do this by sort of getting out there and saying, look, yes, interest rates are low and they're low for a reason, but it would be very foolish to assume that they will never go up again. So they've been saying to households, look, we're not about to pull the trigger on lifting rates, but we will at some point do that. We can't tell you when, but you should just know that we will do it at some point in the future. So as a household sector who is already very highly leveraged in aggregate, effectively, you know, Scott Morrison and Phil Lowe are saying to the household sector, you need to get your balance sheet in order because rates will go up at some point. So they're trying to get the message out there, and I guess that message becomes a lot more powerful when, you know, the reason to invest in a property is, you know, not as compelling as it once was.
Matt Barry says we have to change how we think.
I think one of the important things is we need to change the national conversation away from, you know, how wonderful it is for someone to own five properties and rent them out and so forth, to one about we need to have a good hard think about what industries we need to be creating in this country and that will meaningfully contribute to the GDP in the future. And this is not a short-term fix. This is something that's going to take a decade or two to be able to do.
Property has a particular place in Australian society, actually in the English-speaking countries more widely. Timo Henkel.
There are cultural differences to what extent we view real estate and housing as a speculative target. I've mentioned before that I'm from Germany, and the acceptance to speculate on housing in Germany, for example, and many other countries in continental Europe is much, much lower. The population basically demands from the government to limit price increases, to limit rents, and simply do not tolerate the kind of speculative behavior that is widespread in many Anglo-Saxon economies. In Germany, for example, again, or many other continental European countries, houses are not sold by auction, residential property. It's unheard of and would be considered unethical almost. So it's interesting why different societies have different views of what can be a target of speculative behaviour and whatnot.
Germany isn't Australia. It's a more complicated economy, and notably a manufacturer of high-value goods.
You can have an expensive workforce if you produce higher and higher margin goods. I mean, look at Silicon Valley. There's some of the most expensive wages in the world are in Silicon Valley, yet the companies they're producing are incredibly scalable, global in nature, and really in terms of revenue per employee numbers that some of these companies like Apple produce, they're off the charts. They're phenomenal businesses. These are the sorts of businesses we need to be producing. We need to really build a strong, vibrant technology industry. I mean, Israel's a good example of a country that has done that. There's many examples you could draw from there. We need to work on higher-end manufacturing. We need to, I think, core to all of this is we need a more robust educational system. You know, we'd get more. If you go and talk to any kid and you say, would you like to work on SpaceX or, you know, self-driving cars or Google Glass or build the next Facebook? Every young kid would love to be involved in the technology industry, but they just cannot connect the dots between what they're taught in primary school and secondary school with a career in technology.
We can perhaps change our economy, and our culture's changing now. What we can't change is human nature.
This is why bubbles are fascinating, because in the end, they are just driven by human behaviour. And a lot of that is herd behaviour. So, you know, people get involved in bubbles because their best friend is doing it, their family is doing it, everyone's talking about it, the taxi driver's talking about it. And so there's this whole fear of not wanting to miss out on whatever the latest bubble is. And so, you know, I think it's either the sort of herd behaviour or convincing yourself that this time is different. All those things are sort of things that we see repeated by humans over the decades, and probably tells us that, you know, as a race, we are really a bunch of slow learners.
At least we're consistent, really consistent.
I think there are always going to be bubbles. There will always be speculative behaviour. There will always be people looking to make a quick buck somewhere. There will always be people trying to build Ponzi schemes and to be the first ones in and out to benefit from them. But that does not mean that we as policymakers are impotent. That doesn't mean that we should just stand by the sidelines and watch all this happen. If it affects as important an asset as people's homes, I think as policymakers we have a duty to try to come up with policies that limit the excesses around that speculative behavior in those markets.
I'm forever blowing bubbles. Pretty bubbles in the air. They fly so high.
Thanks to Timo Henkel, lecturer in the Research School of Economics at the ANU, Sally Auld, who's the chief economist at JP Morgan, Preston Teeter from the School of Commerce at the University of South Australia, and Matt Barry, founder and CEO at freelancer.com. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Isabella Tropiano. I'm Richard Ady.
I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles.